This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are hosted by Anton Angelo and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, on podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to the show. Tonight we're hosted by me, Shane Gallagher, with our regular panel, Samuel Mann. And our guest tonight is Dr. Rebecca Ford, and we'll be speaking to her later on. But first of all, I've got my number of the week, and that is 1.4 billion. And that's 1.4 billion sterling. And that's the pre-tax global profits of Glencore, which is one of the world's largest commodities trading companies. And it's come under fire from the United Nations international aid agencies and governments all around the world after it described the current global food crisis and soaring world prices as a good business opportunity. So Glencore's Director of Agricultural Trading, Chris Mahoney, sparked a controversy when he said, "The environment is a good one. High prices, lots of volatility, a lot of dislocation, tightness, a lot of arbitrage opportunities. We will be able to provide the world with solutions, and that should also be good for Glencore." So the senior economist at the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization, Concepcion Calpe, said that private companies like Glencore are playing a game that will make them enormous profits. And what are those other companies? Well, they're corporations like Monsanto and ADM. And what they're doing is using the current food crisis as a way to play the market and increase their profits. And so this has come about as a result of the theme I've been talking about over the last couple of weeks, which has been the extreme climate events that have been happening all over the world, and the severe drought that's been affecting the United States, which has brought down the corn and grain crops to about 60%, maybe 50% of their usual output. And Russia's been affected as well. And Russia is in fact contemplating banning grain exports this year. So we're looking at a massive grain shortage across the world, as Russia and America produce huge amounts of their world's supply of grain and corn. And this is kind of typical of the capitalism's response to the world, these world crises, in that they see them as opportunities to make profit, to actually make a bit of money. And kind of reminds me of this cartoon I saw where this this businessman's given a presentation, and he says that we've got this we look at this pre-global, you know, we've got looking at this crisis that's going to happen and a global apocalypse, but we see like an opportunity for massive profits just before the crisis hits. So that's kind of what we're seeing here with these companies. Okay, thank you very much.
Sustainable Lens on Radio.
Sam, what have you got for us this week?
It's interesting you're talking about gameplay there. In a different sense, I'm talking about gaming as well. I've been reading an interesting paper by Carlos Fabricatore and Zimia Lopez called Sustainability Learning Through Gaming, an Exploratory Study. You'll know that I've been looking at gameplay and different ways of engaging people in sustainability. And the big challenge, I think, is to look for, you know, how people are engaging people in systems thinking, the big challenge of, you know, sort of museums and games and things, and looking at places where game design sort of damages the sustainability game's utility, things like Electro City, which have got so much promise but don't deliver on it. So they've done an analysis of a whole pile of games that purport to support learning of sustainability. So they say educating for sustainability demands approaches and tools promoting systems thinking and learning to deal with traits of complexity such as change, uncertainty, and emergence. So they're saying that gaming is a useful way of learning those sorts of things. Unfortunately, they use a pretty simplistic model of sustainability, but we'll forgive them that, because they do move on to some interesting mechanics work. I like this quote that they say. Game designers should be, in the first place, be skilled and sensitive toy makers, capable of building a comprehensive yet parsimonious set of core and satellite mechanics. They should then be architects capable of building apparently complex gameplay structures with as few toys as possible. And I quite like that idea of engaging people in quite complex ideas in a way that they think it's a game. So, and there's lots of things that we can learn from the sort of gamification of e-commerce and the web and things. So, you know, if you're browsing on the web and you collect points for something, that sort of stuff. But then when they look at the actual games, they're quite disappointed, and they find quite a lot of sort of things that purport to be a really good game, but it turns out to be a sort of a question and answer dynamics, you know, Trivial Pursuit type thing, you know. Unfortunately, they didn't include sort of the big immersive games like Farmville, because I think that kind of thing does do what they want, although the trouble with that is the if you're trying to get a message across, it's quite hard if you lose the structures and things in the narrative. If you're trying to make a great big movie, mm-hmm. and you've got a really good story narrative, it's really hard then to let people like play with that narrative, which is the challenge mm-hmm. of games, particularly if you've got what's called the fallacy of choice. If you've got somebody standing on one side of the river and you say, well, you've got this choice, you can swim across this river or you can pay the man the money to go in the boat across the river. Well, does that mean I'm choosing the direction of the game? It's particularly if the next scene you've got is on the other side of the river. Mm. I mean, big deal, I get to choose whether I swim or take a boat. How about if I go over there instead? That looks interesting. And it's kind of that looking over there, that looks interesting, that is the key to sustainability. So it's an interesting paper in that they say that there's lots of promise in this space, but they're not there yet, so...
So, what kind of drivers would push games companies to produce games like this? I mean,
well, most of them aren't really games companies. Most of them are being done by people with sort of the desire to improve sustainability. Mm-hmm. I think we've talked before about the game Flux, the card game Flux, and I think that does a really good job of engaging people in the sorts of skills that we're looking for in sustainability. There's a creative thinking, cooperation, keeping sight of the bigger goal rather than the details of the mechanics. So what I'd like to see is more people trying to use that kind of approach. I interviewed when I was in the States, Stefan Kreitmeier, mm-hmm. who's got a program or has developed a system called Four Decades, which is about engaging sort of decision makers who are at a workshop in how are we going to make decisions over the long term, and engaging them in a very simple model of climate change, but as a way to engage them in discussion. So it's not the purpose is not to say, okay, what you're going to do is set the world at 4.6 and 3.9 and turn the handle and let it go. It's a way to engage people in those. So I see there's some real future in this kind of work. I'm just not quite in the direction that most of the games are at the moment.
Okay, cool. And what about, I'm just imagining here like something like Civilization or one of those games. Marrying that with the ideas of sustainability, where if you mass popular appeal, you've got a really engaging environment. And is there anyone doing anything like that, or is that just simply too big a job for anyone at the moment?
Yes, one of the things that they don't look at in this paper, and as I said before, they didn't look at things like Farmville that have already got that sort of massively multi-user sort of lots and lots of people in a simulation world, and focusing on the engaging. But then what happens is that you then have to decide what is the, you know, how are you going to assess the winning characteristics?
Yeah.
And as I found when I looked at, say, Electrocity, the underlying mechanics become really important. Like, if they set the rules, as they did in Electrocity, to you can win if you maximize your population and income. You can't win by saying, oh, this is a nice little village, let's just leave it like that. And, you know, little village covered, surrounded by forest, that seems like a good idea, but you fail on that one. And so what Stefan and I are working on is a games where you get to set the winning state, and thinking about what is the winning state is part of the engagement process. So perhaps you could do that in those, for want of a better term, pointless games like Civilization, where it's about just creating stuff. There's no real end state. So you, if you could use that for that sort of thing, although that would take quite a long time, if you're going to engage somebody for that length of time, you could engage them in, you know, building something for real or something.
Okay, cool.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Okay, tonight our guest is Dr. Rebecca Ford, and she's a postdoctoral fellow at CSAFE, but she's also employed by the Department of Marketing at the Otago University. And before coming to the University of Otago, Rebecca completed her DPhil in Engineering Department at the University of Oxford, and she was working with Dr. Malcolm McCulloch in the Electrical Power Lab, looking at how to reduce domestic energy consumption. Welcome to the show, Rebecca. And tell me, marketing is all about selling stuff, but you are looking at trying to not sell stuff. How does that work?
I'm not sure. And it's a little bit of an anomaly. The main reason that I'm in the marketing department actually is because of the people that I work with. So you mentioned that I'm working at CSAFE, and one of my main roles there is working on a project called Energy Cultures. And the two lead investigators on this project are Janet Stevenson and Rob Lawson. And Rob Lawson is in the marketing department, and hence my position there. I make no claim to know anything about marketing, consumer psychology. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So how did you get into sustainability? What led you here? Was some event in your childhood?
I wish I could give you some grand story about this was what I wanted to do since I grew up, but I can't. When I was growing up, I think I had dreams of being, you know, everything from a police officer through to an interior designer. I found that I was quite good at engineering, so I went and did that. And in fact, when I started my engineering degree, I'm a really keen skier and snowboarder. And at the time, I thought that I was going in to do engineering to design new skis that would be better and you know, stronger. And I just didn't end up doing that. And more and more, my work took me towards a focus on electrical engineering. And it was a little bit of chance that got me into this field, because in my fourth year as an undergraduate, we had to, you know, take on a research project. And there was this, you know, 180 students or whatever, 180 projects, and you read through the list and you said, oh, I like the look of this one and this one and this one. You could choose five. And then you were randomly assigned to one of those, and I ended up on a project that was titled Reducing Domestic Energy Consumption Through Behavior Modification, which also doesn't quite sound like it belongs in the engineering department, but it was a really interesting project. It was probably one of the first things I'd looked at where we started being quite interdisciplinary, so behavior modification, trying to understand people as well as you know, the technology. And it was so interesting that it led me on to a PhD, and then here I am.
So what brought you to Otago, though? I mean, you know, it's the other side of the world from Oxford.
It is. it was a little bit of, again, a little bit of luck. I was at a conference in America, Behavior, Energy and Climate Change Conference. I think it's the fifth or sixth one this year, and it's a fantastic conference. And I met somebody from New Zealand who was working with ICA at the time, a lady called Sally Blackwell, and she told me about the group at Otago. And I believe the Energy Cultures Project had just recently kicked off, and I wanted to explore somewhere other than the UK, you know, have a bit of a challenge, travel a bit, see the other side of the world. And it just sounded like a fantastic group. And she, you know, raving to me about this group and put me in touch with Janet and Rob. And yeah, it just went from there. And yeah,
so
great.
The close proximity of ski fields was no, or is that just an added bonus?
An added bonus plus the surfing, you know. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, so you arrived here in Otago, and you've met all these people. And how do you like life here? Is it exciting, or?
It's very different. It's very different to city life. So I've lived in London for most of my life, and then Oxford, and so it's definitely different. But we love it. We love the whole kind of outdoors way of life and the do-it-yourself and just kind of get down with it, no pretentiousness, you know, all muck in. The one thing that we hate is the houses because we're so cold. And mm-hmm. I think
I can relate to that, really.
Yeah, and in fact, it's something that comes up all the time, and it's in fact what a huge focus of the Energy Cultures Project is on is looking at energy behaviors, but more specifically looking at space heating and water heating, because they're big issues for us in New Zealand.
Yeah, because I always remember living when I was in Edinburgh, we had a really bad winter. It's minus 17 degrees outside, and I was sitting at the window, nice and warm and cozy in my flat, looking out going, gosh, it's really cold out there, you know. And if that was minus 17 degrees here in Dunedin, I think we'd probably have a lot of frozen people.
Right.
So now the Energy Cultures Project, we had a team of the guys in here, Maria and Daniel and, oh God, I can't remember the last person's name, in here talking about that halfway through the project, and we were dying to find out what the results were. But you've been on a road show.
We have.
You have been with Janet Stevenson, haven't you?
Yes,
so
well, actually, most of the team was on the road show. So Janet was there, Rob Lawson. The other core members of our team are Paul Thorsners, who's from the economics department.
Oh, yes, who was, yeah.
Oh, okay, brilliant. Well, Paul is swanning off in the States at the moment, so he wasn't able to join us. We're also joined on the team by Jerry Carrington, who, again, didn't come up, and our final team member is Barry Barton, who's based at the University of Waikato, but Barry came and joined us. And it was a fantastic 2 days. We are nearing the end of the project. It's a 3-year research project funded by the Ministry for Science and Innovation, and we're just coming to the end of the third year. So, you know, as you can believe, we've got a lot of results so far. And we took our project on the road, and we went up to audiences in Wellington and Auckland, and we gave them an overview of our findings so far.
And there.
Well, but it might do better for me to just kind of recapture what the project was about and just put it into context in case any of your listeners weren't avid listening last time. So like I said, we were really focusing looking at household space heating and water heating. But really the fundamental part of the project was to try and understand people's relationship with energy in their own homes, and looking at how we can make our homes more energy effective. So that's not saying we want people to use less energy. In a lot of cases, especially around Dunedin, people might need to use more energy, but how can they use that energy more effectively? So how can they reduce their waste and also, you know, have healthier, warmer and more energy efficient homes? So these are really the things that we're looking at in the project. And what we realized is it's not particularly simple, and our relationship with energy is hugely complex. And it was interesting listening to you talk about the gamification for sustainability, because a lot of people have explored that around, you know, energy. It's such a complex issue. Can we use games to make it more simple? And the Energy Cultures Project, the research, we really are trying to simplify some of these complexities. So the first step was looking at trying to derive this conceptual framework so we can really understand what we're talking about, frame the problem so we can help sort of frame the solutions. And this conceptual framework led us onto, I think, 5 different research streams, each one probing a different part to give us a better understanding of these issues around energy use. And what we talked about on the roadshow was the results from these findings. So we talked about the framework, and we talked about the results from some of these findings.
So let's start with the framework.
Yep. So our framework is basically saying, you know, what is energy behavior? How can we talk about it so that we each know what we're talking about? We're talking about the same thing. We're on the same page. And what we came down to, and this was obviously based extensively on existing literature and theories, was that our energy behavior is determined by what we call our material culture. So the things that we have in our home, the way our home is built, you know, do I have a heat pump? Do I have a wood burner? So that's kind of one block. The other block is that our energy practices. So what we do with what we have, when do we use our heating? What if we can set a temperature, what temperature do we set it to? And then the third thing is our social norms. So what are our expectations? What do we want our comfort levels to be? And I think, you know, this is sort of quite an interesting one, because I come here and like you said, you know, your norm is being quite warm in your house even when it's minus 17 degrees outside. Mm-hmm. But it's very different here. So these are all kind of the internal parts of the framework, and then realizing that that's not going on in a vacuum, and that we've got all these external influences as well. Things like, what are the financing available? Do you own your home? Are you renting it? So are you able to make changes? So all of these external influences. And I guess one of our key hypotheses for the research was, you know, we know that there's a multitude of factors, so people can have all different sorts of things in their homes and practices around these and social norms. But are we seeing sort of groupings within the population? So are we seeing clusters of energy cultures, as we call them? So that is people with similar sets of these material cultures, energy practices and social norms. And one major stream of our research, and this was led by Rob Lawson actually, was conducting a national survey. So we sent a survey out to, I think it was 2,500 people returned it from across New Zealand, not just Dunedin. And we asked them, I mean, they spent 40 minutes or so filling out the survey, and we asked them lots of questions about the things they have in their home, the way they're using it, their aspirations around energy, their relationship to the environment, sustainability and so on. And what we found, and so one of our key findings, was that actually, yes, we saw our population kind of split into these four clusters, four groupings of people that had very similar sets within the groupings of these material cultures and energy practices. So we've named our groups. We've only just named them. And we have four E's. So we have energy economical, energy extravagant, energy efficient, and energy easy. So these four groupings within the population.
Hang on, slowly. Okay. Because they all start with E, I can't remember what they were.
Energy economical.
Yeah.
So these guys tend to be younger families or students that are flatting together. They tend to rent their accommodation. They're pretty good in terms of what they're doing in their homes. I think a lot of that's possibly driven by lower financial income. But that, you know, they are limited in finance. They're limited in the changes that they can make to improve their homes, both because of the finance, but also because a lot of them are renting, and so they don't have the capability to do that. And often their housing is pretty poor. Our second group was the energy extravagant. And these were families, generally families with teenagers, not exclusively, but, you know, that was kind of their general characteristics. And these guys tended to sort of be more concerned about enjoying life. A lot of them, I think a lot of it was just getting on with life, you know. So they weren't as concerned with sort of energy efficient practices. So they would leave lights on. They were more likely to take long hot showers, playing video games, and they had the highest incomes. The third E's were the energy efficient, and these guys tended to be empty nesters, or they had independent children living at home. And because they were a little bit older, they had a bit more disposable income, they had tended to make upgrades to their homes. They tended to have done insulation. They tended to have fairly efficient practices as well. Quite a few of these guys had wood burners, and they also, a lot of them had separate deep freezers. And so we were wondering, maybe that's a pragmatic thing, you know, you like to get all the food in at once, or maybe cook it a lot and then freeze it. Not entirely sure with that one. And then our fourth group was the energy easy group. And these guys were a little bit older, and they liked their comfort. So, they liked using and leaving heated towel rails on in the bathrooms. They heated their bathrooms. They didn't wait for full loads of washing before putting their laundry in the washing machine. They didn't line dry their clothes. They tended to use tumble dryers. So seems to be more concerned with kind of these easier aspects of life. But one of the really interesting findings that came out of it was that actually these groups were really linked to stage of life cycle. So we start with the kind of younger families or students, following it through to families that are older with teenagers, empty nesters, and then our slightly older population.
Yeah, 'cause I remember when we had first had Paul and Maria and Daniel on, one of the things they were talking about was the behaviour pattern wasn't really linked very closely to their belief system.
Yeah.
So that's something that, you know, you think, oh, if somebody's an environmentalist or somebody's, somebody's not environmentalist, they're quite progressive, you know, whatever their belief system is, that this would map closely to their energy culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want to pull that culture word about out in a second. But these weren't related. And so this is the relationship here. It's the life cycle, isn't it?
We've found that much more so. And actually what we've found is that when you look at these different groupings of people, these different clusters, we're finding that the main differences between the groups relate to what they have in their home, or what that, you know, the building envelope of their home, so their material culture, and their energy practices. And in fact, there wasn't much difference in social norms between the groups at all. We didn't find really significant differences there at all. So that would sort of back up what the others were telling you earlier on in the okay. project.
Do you think that life cycle mm-hmm. is cohort independent? As those people grow up, are they going to take those practices with them, or are they going to morph into their different group?
And that's a really interesting question, and it's not one that I think I could answer right now, because, is some of this, so is our energy efficient group, which some of their practices may seem to be driven by pragmatism, is that an indication of the time in which they grew up and were brought up? Our energy economical group, those guys actually, the youngest group, they do seem to be a little more sort of ecologically aware, but maybe that's because it's, you know, constantly around nowadays. So will they shift through or not? I'm not sure. And this is something that we're hoping that we can answer. We'll come back in 6 years' time and hopefully be able to tell you, because one thing that we'd like to do is roll out our survey to the same group of people, you know, now or next year, and then a few years down the track, so we can try and track changes over time.
Were you able to extract any income level? Is this related to income? Is your energy consumption related to income very much, or is it more closely related to the life cycle? And again, is something kind of
the strongest correlation would be to do with this stage of life cycle, mm-hmm. and that's not necessarily age, but like I said, more life cycle. Mm-hmm. But yes, income is a factor as well, but I think, I'm not sure if it's the main factor or if it's more sort of indicative of the groupings themselves. Mm-hmm. So the energy economical group, these guys do tend to be one of the poorer groups. You know, the energy efficient, which is our third group with the empty netters, they tend to have more disposable income. In fact, the energy extravagant group had the highest income of the lot, but didn't have they also had the highest power bills, but they had, you know, biggest families, maybe different concerns. So I'm not sure that we can say it's completely dependent on income, though we do see some amounts of links.
Why did you use the word cultures? I mean, where did that come from, and how is it a culture?
It's an interesting question. Well, I mean, our research project is called Energy Cultures. Yeah. And so I guess if you wanted to know why they chose that you'd probably have to invite Janet and Robin, because I wasn't even in the country at that point. But I know that a lot of the work leading to the sort of the development of the conceptual framework that I talked about, this idea of our energy behavior being determined by our material culture, energy practices, and cognitive norms, I know that that is based to some extent on culture's literature, but I'm not going to be able to answer any more fully than that. Right. It's not my speciality.
No, because I always remember, years ago, I was looking, talking to some English environmentalists, and they were talking about how, you know, if we wanted to drive sustainability, what we have to do is make it a cultural imperative.
Yeah.
And so it has to be something, you know, a cultural imperative is often something to do with you're having a flash car.
Yep.
You know, that's a created cultural, you know, imperative. It's something that's manufactured by for sustainability, create this cultural imperative to drive it forward. And I was interested in that. I'm quite interested in the idea of culture and the behavioural change. And
I think that's a language thing as well, because what you're calling that cultural imperative, I think that's something that we're trying to capture in this part of the framework that we've called social norms. And in that, you know, we're trying to capture, you know, what are your expectations, and to some extent your expectations are dependent on the context in which you're living in, the people around you, you know. And we've talked about this framework on a household level, you know, what you have in your house, but to some extent you could talk about it across a national level. And, you know, how New Zealanders we have different social norms to the UK for sure, mm-hmm. America, like many other countries. So you can look at it on different scales, and we try to capture that in those social norms.
Did you ask people if they were aware of their energy consumption?
We didn't. No.
I was just wondering, do people know which of those, I know these are clusters that arrived, but do people see themselves in that kind of space of how much energy they use, even if they don't know the details?
We are hoping to try and get that out of some upcoming work. We'd like to conduct some interviews, in-depth interviews with people, to try and see whether people do self-identify into these different clusters. But we can't tell you that based on the data that we have, because you know, as you know, these clusters were derived from many different questions that were asked, and they weren't, you know, we didn't go into this research thinking that we would have these four clusters based on, you know, the material culture and the practices. It quite easily could have come and been more dependent on the social norms. So they were derived from the data. We didn't go in with that expectation that it would be life cycle dependent, or, you know.
I wonder if people would be more aware of what classification other people would fit into.
I think actually you are kind of aware of your own, because I know when we've been talking to people, and just anecdotally, I know which one I fit into, and I know which one my co-workers fit into, and they all know as well.
Yeah, so. And my kids know which my mother fits into. But do the kids know that they leave the lights on all the time?
Probably not, because I think that something like that, you know, you're not necessarily aware of. I'm aware of it. I used to live with someone, and I would walk around after them turning the lights off in every room, and they would always leave them on, and they weren't aware of it at all. But part of that leaving the lights on, though, is just because it's such a habitual behaviour. And it wasn't meant to say that, you know, if you leave the lights on, you belong in that group. It's just to say that people in this group, that's one of the things that they tend to do. Not everybody in that group goes around leaving the lights on, but it is something that is more indicative of members of that group.
So you haven't yet in this project done any work on how to influence those different groups?
Oh, we have.
Oh,
I mean, that's one of five research findings that we've talked about.
Let's go with the rest then.
But I just want to say, like, one of the key things for us is not just the findings, but it's the implication of the findings, you know. And what this work has said to us is that really, if we're looking to change energy behaviour, it's quite clearly not a one-size-fits-all solution. And so, you know, for example, the energy economical group, where a lot of them are renters, the landlord-tenant issue is just going to be a huge factor in there. So, you know, can we look at some kind of certification for homes similar to what we have as a warrant of fitness for cars, you know, or a TripAdvisor for homes? You know, maybe that would be a good solution. And for our energy extravagant group, you know, these guys, they're not really concerned with saving energy right now. They're not motivated around that. So, you know, what can we do to help motivate them around that, or make it easier for them? So, like, maybe different pricing incentives or home energy management systems, because these guys are really very busy getting on with their life, you know, as they should be, probably with young kids at home. So would a nice system that could manage things for them appeal? So, you know, we could go on, but it was just a nice finding for us that, you know, we've got to really consider when we're looking to change behaviour. We've got, one of the key things for us is the context of the people that we're talking to. One of the other themes that we saw coming out of the research was again, it was related to trying to induce a change. But we saw, as well as seeing this segmentation within our population according to, you know, their material culture and their energy practices, we also saw a segmentation for people's preferences for different types of energy consuming appliances. And we got at this in two ways. So one way we looked at this was Paul led a piece of analysis looking at choice modeling. So what they did is they focused on space heating and water heating, and they asked people a series of questions that said to them, would you prefer a system that had A and B, or would you prefer it if it had C and D, you know? And people would say, oh, I like this one more, or I like that one more, or they're equal, you know? And it would run through these series of questions, probing people for their preferences for these different attributes of heating and hot water systems. So that was one way we looked at it. And the other way was we ran six different focus groups. We ran two in Auckland, two in Wellington, and two in Dunedin. And we talked to people that had made changes in their homes or wanted to make changes in their homes, and we asked them specifically about what they wanted to do next, and you know, so what was the next change they wanted to make. And so from these two different sort of sets of research, we ended up with some more interesting results that showed us actually what people want to do is very different but again, it kind of clusters. So our choice modeling, when we looked at space heating and water heating, we actually found five groupings of people according to those things that were important to them in, you know, space heating systems and water heating systems. And so there was one group of people in that for whom the most important thing to them about replacing, you know, a new type of heating system or water heating system was how much it was going to cost up front, which, you know, makes sense. But there was a second group whose sort of key criteria for what they chose if they were going to replace their space or water heating system was the running cost of it and whether they would recover the money they spent on the sale of their house. So it wasn't so much the upfront cost, but, you know, would they make it back over the lifetime of the appliance? A third group were really keen on reliability, and that is that, you know, their heating system did what it was meant to do. A fourth group, their biggest thing was the aesthetics of it. And I personally don't know that I think of a heat pump as being particularly, you know, aesthetically pleasing system. No, <it's> not. No, but no, it was whether it fit with their house or fit with their neighbours. And I guess if you start thinking like of things like solar water heating, then that starts to make sense and fall into place, you know. And our last group, and this was a finding that did surprise us, that the most important thing about their space or water heating system was that they had some grid independence, so they were somewhat independent from their power company. And that really surprised us, and that was across the population. It wasn't just, you know, in one particular region. We saw similar things with our focus groups. We didn't cluster people in this was more of a discussion, so we actually listened to people's stories and what they wanted to do. And you know, people would tell us that they wanted to do all different things. So some people wanted to double glaze their home. Some people really wanted insulation to insulate their ceiling or underfloor. Other people, what they wanted to do was change their heating technology. Some wanted to upgrade their appliances. Some really wanted to change their lighting system. They wanted more energy efficient lighting. So when we talked to people, what we realized is, okay, so your preference for that type of system, so the key factor of that system is important, but then also your next choice, what you're going to do next is also very important. And we asked people as well what would help them change, and obviously money and finance, winning the lottery whatever was the most important, but their second thing was better information. So what we've really taken to heart from these two pieces of work was that, as well as people being in these different contexts, these different clusters, so they've got different things that are available to them, different situational constraints. For a change to happen, another one of the key issues is the access to this appropriate, tailored, and personalized energy information that accounts for not only their context, but also their preferences.
What's the relationship between the groups, that group, and
the
previous framework? Yeah.
A little bit, but not really. No, we didn't really see a big overlap. Part of that might be because when we did this piece of work, we tended to be speaking to homeowners. So with the choice modelling, we only asked homeowners about this because we were talking about such big changes. We were asking people to imagine changes to their space heating systems or water heating systems. So we didn't expect that to be the sort of thing that people that were renting would be thinking about actively. So given that, you know, one of our groups has a lot of renters in it, it wouldn't be entirely fair to map the two clusters onto one another.
And you're asking the parents and a family for that one.
Yes.
Whereas before, you're looking at the whole family in a sense. In the previous clusters.
Yes.
It was categorising a family or a household.
Yes. Yes, it was.
So the more information might help in this rational decision making.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to help the teenagers turn the lights off.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And but one thing about this research project is that the focus was on space heating and water heating. Now, that doesn't mean that we were only talking to people about new systems, because obviously there's a lot of actions that you can take, you know, as a renter, as a child, you know, closing the curtains at night makes a difference. You've got to have curtains, of course, but there's a lot of different actions that you can take as well, shorter showers. But we weren't focusing mainly on sort of lighting and appliances, which I think is what you would tend to associate with teenagers and younger children. But you're right, we were. And also with this choice modelling, when we asked people about their preferences, we might not have been talking to the decision maker in the house.
The other point is that when you're in that point of making that decision, sometimes you're not able to like sit down and think about this rationally. You're on the phone, the plumber has said your hot water cylinder's died, he'll get you a new one, but it has to be this sort or it's not going to be done until after Christmas.
Absolutely.
So these important decisions we're making, we don't really get actually a proper time to sit down and think about them.
No, you're right. A lot of the time we don't. And we asked people in our household survey about if they had replaced their water heating recently, and I'm sure we asked them about their space heating, but this is the one that sticks in my mind. And when people said that they had replaced it, we asked them why, and the overpowering answer was because the old one had broken. So you're right, it's change is complex. It doesn't necessarily give us all the time in the world that we need to sit down and make these logical, thought out decisions. And this idea that changing something is complex was reflected time and again, because as well as doing these sort of surveys with many people, we also ran a number of focus groups where we got to chat to fewer people, but we got to hear their stories. And what we started to realize is that this change process, it's a process. It's not something that happens instantaneously. So people would tell us these huge stories about why they were changing things or why they wanted to. And often it wouldn't really start with energy. It might start with health. The children had asthma, you know? It would start in many places. But what we were able to try and do with this is to say, okay, the change is complex. It's often not a rational or logical decision. But there are a number of factors that surround the change process. And Janet's recently done some great work looking at breaking these many factors that people were talking to us about into four kind of main categories around the change process. And the first one's drivers of change. So, you know, why are you changing something? Yes, you might be changing something because it breaks and you need to change it instantly. But actually, a lot of people that we were talking to were thinking about wanting to make a change because of some drivers. So, for example, what they've got at the moment might be bad for their health. The kids might have asthma. It might have really high running costs. You know, they're sick of all the monthly power bills. And you're right, sometimes the driver is because the technology breaks down and you need to replace it. And you need to do that quickly. But then when you're thinking about what you're going to change it to, there's a number of attractors as well as the drivers. So the drivers are kind of pushing you, and the attractors, you can think of them as pulling you. So that might be that, you know, the new technology that you're going to move to might be easier than the old one. So, for example, some people were saying they liked heat pumps over wood burners because they were so much easier. They could come in, push a button, and it was on, as opposed to, you know, chopping the wood and bringing it in every night and that whole process. Sometimes the attractors would be that it just fit better with their values. So some people that might be more ecologically concerned, you know, using electricity or a pellet boiler or something where you would feel like you're generating your own electricity might be better than using gas to do the same sort of thing. So the attractors was the second one. The third one was the choosing part. So regardless of why you need this new technology, you have to make a choice. And that's knowing what to do, what options you have, the timing associated with it, what works best for your own circumstances. And then the fourth part was enabling. And that was things like access to the right sort of information and advice. It would be things like financial assistance, feeling that you're competent to make that change, and getting support from your friends and family. And we looked at all of these things together, and we looked at the stories from the focus groups, and we started to see just how important this support from friends and family was, because time and again in all the stories that we were told, there would be references to friends and family and, oh, you know, my mum did that and then my brother did that, so I thought we should do it, you know, or, oh, they gave me some really good information. And we were really starting to see how influential people's friends and families were in this process, far more so than anyone else. And we actually ran a piece of research that I don't think we'd intended to at the beginning, but we ran a social network analysis in Northeast Valley. And we really wanted to try and dig into this idea of our friends and families being our main source of advice, you know, in a lot more detail. So we ran out a survey in Northeast Valley, and we chose Northeast Valley because, well, for one, it's a transition town, and there's a lot of community groups there specifically focused around sustainability and around energy. So we actually thought that we went into this thinking that they would be really, really influential. And we asked people, we sat ourselves outside New World in, you know, a couple of mornings in the week, and we just stopped people as they were, you know, heading in or out with their shopping. And we asked them a number of questions, but kind of the running theme was how influential various different groups or people were in helping them to make decisions or take actions around household energy consumption or their energy use. And so we asked them, you know, about community groups. So we asked them about Transition Valley 473, Sustainable Dunedin City, Northeast Valley Community Gardens, and other community groups in the areas. We asked them about organizations. How helpful were various organizations like ECA, their power company, the DCC? We asked them how helpful they found different media sources like Energy Spot on TV and the Otago Daily Times, The Star, Consumer Institute Mag. And then we also asked them how helpful were various people to them, like their family, their friends, their colleagues and neighbours. And what we found was that people were 3 to 4 times more influential than any of the other sources. Mm. So we started to realise that there's this huge opportunity to tap into social networks to help people make this change process. And you know, trying to start increasing conversations around energy, but also to make sure that the information that's flowing through these social networks is sound. So, like, how can we help bring energy into our everyday conversations, but make sure the right sort of energy is flowing through these social networks? Sorry, the right sort of information is flowing through.
Because gossip's not very reliable.
No, and often, you know, Chinese whispers, you start off with one thing and end up with something completely different.
So how do we intervene to... Do we just have to keep feeding the right information in?
That's a good question. And we are in the last phase of our project at the moment, and we're rolling out an intervention study. And so hopefully some people that are listening might know about this. And we are doing an intervention study. We're doing it with the help of the Blue Skin Resilient Communities Trust. And we're offering people in Blue Skin Bay and Northeast Valley home energy audits, where we're just providing people with energy advice on an individual level. But in Brockville, we're trying something a little bit different. And we were really lucky that the community invited us up to a potluck dinner on the Sunday just gone. And they have a guest speaker. I think it's once a month, and they have a guest speaker. And Chris, who's our guy at BRCT, who's the energy guru, he was invited to give a talk, and we went up there and we basically got conversations started around energy. And we had sort of a big conversation at the beginning where we talked about quite general concepts and people were, you know, throwing up questions. It was quite interactive. And then people broke up into smaller groups and were able to have more one-on-one or not quite one-on-one, but, you know, smaller group discussions with Chris and Maureen Howard, who has run a number of sustainable living courses as well. She came and helped us out. And they were, and people were able to talk to their friends and neighbors, talk about energy, but have somebody who had a lot of practical knowledge there to throw that into the mix. And so the energy cultures team is wrapping an evaluation piece around that, because that's what we want to know. We want to know how effective is this at increasing people's energy literacy and encouraging behavior change, encouraging the right sort of communication through the community. And so we've got two more events planned up there if they invite us back, which we're hoping that they do.
That's brilliant.
A couple of questions. Energy literacy, you haven't used that term before.
Yep.
That's like reading?
Well, it means, I think it means, it's one of these terms that means different things depending on who you're talking to. So what we're really meaning by this is people's knowledge around energy related information. And by that, I don't mean sort of the physics and engineering concepts, but more the energy related information about the way in which they're using energy in their homes, what appliances are using more or less, what is energy, you know, to them in a way that relates to household energy consumption.
Of the people that can't read, to mm-hmm. stumble along with an analogy, mm-hmm. are there persistent myths?
What do you mean, sorry?
Are there things that people get wrong in a persistent sort of way that you know, is there a myth out there that I don't know, I'm making stuff up, pellet burners are less efficient than energy, than electricity? I just made that up. I've no idea what the relationship is there.
And I don't either. We'd need to ask our energy expert.
But I'm not so much concerned about the specifics, but do people get things wrong and hold dear to those things?
Yeah, I mean, I'm convinced they do, and I can just look at my own family for great examples of that. You know, my mum's convinced that unless she does her laundry at 100 degrees centigrade, things won't get cleaned. You know, so I think that there are myths out there. I think that there's a lack of information. So one thing that we talked to people about was, so one of the things we were talking to people about was the plastic, the film glazing that you can get instead of double glazing. It's not perfect, but you know, I put it in my home and it certainly helps. I can touch my not quite the windows, you know, I can touch the glazing and it's not like an ice trap. So it was surprising. A lot of people didn't know about it, didn't know it existed. If they knew it existed, didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know what to do with it until somebody came around and showed me how to put it on. So I think, yes, there are myths. Yes, there's just a lack of information. I think also it's tempting to believe that if you're in a rental situation and you are limited in what you can do, that you can't do anything. When, you know, the glazing, yes, you know, it does cost, but it's not hugely expensive. And I suspect, and I haven't quantified this, but I suspect in my home that I've saved money through using it.
Back up to the Back up to the about encouraging conversations,
mm-hmm.
and you're looking, or you're doing some studies with intervening in a community by going out and, you know, talking to that community. That's not a very scalable model, because the CSAFE people aren't going to be able to go out and talk to every community in the country.
No.
So how do we learn from that to pull out something that we can scale up?
Well, something that's really been important to us with this community engagement part of the project is that it's not just CSAFE people going out and talking to people in the community. What we're really looking to do is build up kind of a community, something that can be ongoing and perpetuating within the community, and build up sort of local expertise within the community who may already be there. I suspect there are probably a lot of people within the community that are very knowledgeable. But, you know, we use energy in our homes every day, but we don't think about it. You know, when I go home and I work in this field, I'm working around this subject 9 to 5, more than that normally, every day. And I go home, and when I turn my lights on, or I watch the TV, or I put the fire on, I am not thinking about, oh, what am I using in energy? But it's underlying that. So I think that a lot of the time we don't have conversations about it because it's not explicit. It's not, you know, kind of there in front of our noses. So a big part of this is just bringing it more into that community dialogue, so that it doesn't have to be sea safers going out and talking.
You could say that we've done a fabulous job as a society at hiding that information from us on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
We want to turn the light on, and we want to get light. We don't want to know that there's coal power stations firing up because of that.
Absolutely.
If you're multiplied out of it. So why are we doing this? Do we need to do this?
Do we need to be more aware of what we're using? I think we do. We're a growing population, and there are limited resources, and it's all well and good being able to do what we want when we've been able to do it. But as we move forwards, as we look forwards to the next, I don't know, even 25 years, well, I mean, as we look forwards to the next 25 years, and our government has laid this target on us of going to 90% renewables in the near future, and we're looking to more and more wind power, and we're looking to more and more solar power, we're going to have to become more aware, because these power sources are not something that we can just flick a switch and turn it on when we want. We're going to have to start managing what we're doing in a better way, so that our supply can meet, that our supply and demand can be balanced.
I like the fact that you said that it's not necessarily about using less all the time. It's about being healthier, warmer, and more. On the remote controls in our sitting room, of which there's several, I counted yesterday because I couldn't believe it, 171 buttons.
Oh my gosh.
And one of them says eco on it, and it's for the heat pump, and essentially it makes the heat pump not work. So we've still got this kind of feeling that eco is less.
Yes.
That, you know, if you want to be eco, you're not going to be as warm.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow we need to change that, don't we?
We do, and I think that will come. I think a big part of that is this changing the social norms. And I was at a conference last year, and I had a great talk, and I can't remember who it was by, which is awful. And they were talking about washing machines and settings on washing machines. And why is it that the settings are like normal and eco? Why isn't it normal and kill the world? You know, why is the normal setting not the eco setting, when it would work just as well? And but you know, that I think they're different things, and I think what we really need to look at is this idea of energy effectiveness. So can we use energy in a better way, so that we have warmer, healthier homes, but we are also not wasting as much energy, that we are using those eco settings? And you're right, it will come, because I think as more and more people do it, it will become more of the norm. And that's what we're hoping with these conversations, you know, as more and more people start to have conversations around this idea of energy and how you're using it in the home, and actually making it something we're aware of, it will start to become more of a norm, and it will be self-propagating.
Yeah, because I always remind, you know, when I came over here, double glazing is like some sort of alien concept too. And the thing is, it's like, you know, back home, it's one of those things that you instantly do. You move into a house, you renovate it, double glazing, the first thing goes in, central heating. That's what goes in. And but we've got time for one more question. We're running out of time. We always run out of time. Sam, do you have one more question?
One more question? No, I've got lots and lots to talk about projects that we're working on, the Community Sustainable Enterprise Project, which I've just seen an incredible link with, so I'm going to talk to you about it as soon as we finish, and I'll talk about it more on the show at a later date.
Brilliant. Okay, so I think we're going to have to wind it up now, and although we've tons more to talk about, I know we do, because I'm looking at your amazing sheets of paper in front of you. Okay, this has been the show for the 23rd of August, 2012. Our guest was Dr. Becky Ford, and our panellist was Professor Samuel Mann, and your host was me, Shane Gallagher. Our music, when we have it, is sourced from the Free Music Archive, and you get podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe to us, our show on iTunes, or on otagoaccessradio.org.nz, and we hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.